altitude, altitude, and altitude. It can be a simple, in the case of a VHF antenna, something that's made out of coat hanger wire. Let me drop.
D3ZTZ, so we've lost the audio now for about 2 minutes. Post adjustment, we can't hear you anymore. D3ZTZ, we cannot hear the net.
Send delay haptic.
Yeah, Scott, ZTZ, DE3ZTZ, we know that the resetting of the machine is not working very well down here. We're overcoming a problem. We're familiar with what you're saying there, Scott, so we're going to try to be working on that. So, that atmosphere is darn close to the Earth in reality, when you look at it at a global size, global scale. Many of us, the average guy who I've asked to draw a picture of the Earth, draw a circle that represents the Earth, and then draw a picture, a circle around that represents the atmosphere. They draw the atmosphere as another 40% further radius out, and it's not. It would be the thickness of the pencil as the radius out there. So angle of radiation, as Alan is telling us, is extremely important, and you only get that from altitude when you're using horizontally polarized antennas. So no matter how, if you had the choice of building a zillion-dollar antenna on the ground as opposed to something that's very inexpensive and low in performance, but it's up high, you're probably going to do better with that second antenna. The third guy who signed in was Steve. KB2GLI, I think it is, Steve. I'll go right ahead with your question. Hope we have no trouble hearing you. K2LIW.
Okay. Just want to get back to the point about hiding antennas. Just tell me if I'm making it and I'll continue.
To me, you're making it, because I'm... to repeat, Steve, to me you're making it because I'm listening to what comes through the machine and gets reflected to 975-375. I will admit the portions of what you said was not coming out on 85. Give it another try, K2LIW.
Okay, let me get right to the question. A few weeks back, you guys were talking about putting up a dipole. Now, I've become a cave dweller down here. And my HF gear has been in the bin for a couple of years. I decided to go ahead and make an indoor antenna. I went for 20 meters. I cut some wire. It seemed to work pretty good. You know, I did the usual. I put in the poor man's balun, put in some ferrite chokes and stuff, and I'm able to talk up and down the whole country. But my question is this. I borrowed an antenna analyzer, and, you know, I measured the points of the frequency where I was going to be working, and then I tuned for the lowest SWR, and it was about 2 megahertz down. It was like about 12 megahertz. So I figured, well, I'll trim it. I took off about 3 inches and improved a little bit, but I don't know whether I should continue to trim it or whether I should just let the antenna tuner take up the slack.
That's a darned question, Al. So Alan's in Ocala, Florida. And what he's telling us, stand by for a second. Okay, there it is. His antenna, he starts cutting off pieces of it in order to bring it into resonance. It's working better and better, but he's afraid to keep cutting off more for fear that it's hard to go back. And there's two things here in your favor, Alan. Number one is that, stand by. Okay, there it is. Number one is that even if you take off too much wire and you decide you're going too far and you've got to twist some extra wire back on there. Although it may mechanically look a little bit homely, extra twisted wire with or without solder is still going to give you 99.9% of the performance. So adding wire back after you cut it is not a problem. I know mechanically you don't like doing that because it's weakening the antenna. But your second part of your question is, if you allow the resonance to be reestablished by way of an antenna tuner, is that giving you full performance? And there I got some good news for you. Answer is absolutely yes. And there's a huge misunderstanding on this one. Let me drop. You ask any of the guys on 3 meters. If I've got an antenna with, let me pick a number, 3.5-to-1 standing wave ratio, where half the power is being reflected, and you can measure it on your bird watt meter. And now you've got your antenna tuner giving you a perfect impedance match between the 50-ohm transmitter and the antenna. And they ask the question, what's happening to that 50% reflected power? And the answer is it all gets radiated, except for the little bit of extra loss of the feed line because the energy is bouncing back and forth. The magic of an antenna tuner is that it's thoroughly shielded. It can't radiate the energy. If it's well constructed, it runs ice cold. It gives you a perfect impedance match on the transmitter. Every bit of the 100 watts out of the transmitter is going through that antenna tuner and arriving at the transmitting antenna. So to reestablish resonance of an antenna by way of an antenna tuner is a beautiful way to go. And except for a little bit of extra loss in the feed line, you come out ahead. Don't worry about it. As I said, most people think that all of the reflected power to an antenna tuner, that the antenna tuner just throws it away. By the laws of conservation of energy, it cannot do that. That energy does get radiated. It's just bouncing back and forth a couple of times in the feed line before it gets there. So I think you've got it made, and you're a lot better off than you realize, Steve. I presume you're talking to us by IOLP from Ocala, Florida. KB2GLI, K2LIW in the SECNAT.
Okay, I'm actually talking to you on Echolink. When I lived up in Huntington, I used to have a G5RV. I was very involved with Limark, and I'm really glad to be able to come back on Echolink. My antenna, I'm using a 24-gauge wire, so I can hide it in the living room. You really can't see it. And it's pinned up on the ceiling by about 6 plant hooks, and I have it bent over at 90 degrees on each end, and I was really surprised how well it worked.
That doesn't surprise me at all, Alan. Bent over in the ends and works like a charm. As I've often said, in order for an antenna to radiate, you must resonate it first. And when I say antenna, I mean antenna radiating structure. Your antenna, your feed line, and the antenna tuner. That combination, you've got to resonate it. And if you resonate it by taking the wire, zigzagging it, turning it down on the ends, adding top hat capacitors, adding loading coils at the bottom, loading coils at the middle, no matter what you do in order to make it electronically resonant, even though the physical length is wrong, even though the physical layout is wrong, as long as it electronically resonates, it's got 95% of all the ability to do the radiating, because the real radiating is the signal bouncing back and forth in what you and I call the radiating structure, and you want all those bounces to stay in phase, in step with each other. That's what the word resonance means. All the bounces stay in step. So you found a way of mechanically zigzagging, bending, and whatever to establish resonance. Therefore, it's going to radiate. Therefore, it's going to radiate well. Therefore, except for any altitude problems you've got or maybe some absorption of the building and a little bit of blockage from nearby buildings, that's going to work like a charm. And I think that's what you're proving there, Steve. K2GLI, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, thank you. And the other side is it only cost me $11 to make. Okay, on that note, I'll send it back to you, and I'm done. Thank you for your answer.
Looks like I better keep talking on 975-375. Okay, 24-gauge wire inside the house, working that well. Looks like a charm. I guess you could even hide it up under the rug. Out of curiosity, is some of that hidden under the rug in your Ocala house there, Steve? KP2GLI, K2LW?
Negative, Dick. My $11 antenna is hung in the ceiling by 6 plant hooks. It's kind of like a C-shape. And the only part of it you can see is the feed line. It comes down, but I dress it up in such a way they can only see about a foot of it.
That sounds very crafty. I think you should write an article on that antenna, Alan. You found another way of hiding the antenna inside the abode in the way that the XYL is happy, the landlord is happy, the neighbors see nothing, and you're on the air. Have you considered writing an article on that one, Alan?
Okay, Dick. Actually, what I really want to do is some experimentation. I like the conversation on the inverted V. I wanted to play around and just see how far I could go with this. I mean, could I add another radio? Could I, you know, what possibilities are there out here that I could play with?
Okay. What your structure is doing is resonating. That's the first requirement. And now, all the 100 watts you're putting into that, a good number of them, 95% of them, are being radiated somewhere in the space. The next level of improvement to get higher directivity, other than altitude, all you got to do is take your apartment and put it on stilts and raise it 50 feet in the air. Of course, I'm kidding here, Steve. So, shy of making the antenna higher up, the next level of improvement is by adding extra directivity. The Yagi-like structures, a reflector and or director, a director or reflector, will now give you higher gain in some particular chosen direction, and there's a little bit of a rub. You could, if you want to, if you've got enough space in the apartment, string another dipole-like structure without a feed line, and depending on how you resonate it, if it resonates high, it's a director, if it resonates low, it's a reflector, and you're going to put it in the vicinity of a quarter wavelength away. And you're going to have to do a little bit of experimenting with that. So broadside, another piece of wire, a quarter wavelength away, and you could put electronic tuning in the center of that piece of wire, where you throw an inductor when you want it to be a reflector, you switch it remotely with relay to a capacitor when you want it to be a director. So that piece of wire that gives you a Yagi-like structure, the parasitic piece of wire, could direct your signal in one direction when it's a reflector, in another direction when it's a director, and you can electronically make it go from one to the other. It's a little bit like the stepper IR technique, but you can do it electronically. And now, you can, if your antenna as a Yagi is going to favor east, you can make it as a Yagi favor the west by making the director into a reflector. So that's the next level of improvement other than altitude, is to start start experimenting with Yagi-like structures, and there's nothing, let me drop for a second. There's nothing magic about the Yagi being, what's the word I'm looking for here, being a real boom-mounted director or boom-mounted reflector. You're creating electronic resonance with 26-gauge wire by flipping in a capacitor or an inductor in order to, with a remote relay, to change that from a director to a reflector. Therefore, you're selecting the direction of transmission with extra gain. The slight disadvantage of this, of course, is that in order for you to radiate at right angles to the structure, it's not going to be so easy. The good news about directivity with parasitic elements, let me drop extra directivity with parasitic elements, is that you're narrowing up the beamwidth, you're squirting more signal in one direction like a flashlight. That's the good news. The bad news is that when you're squirting signal like a flashlight, you're subtracting signal from some other direction, if you know what I mean. So, I got an idea now, Alan. You can make it three different antennas. By plugging in with a remotely powered relay, you plug in a coil in the center of this parasitic element, it's a reflector. Plug in a capacitor, it's a director. Plug in something else that brings it very far away from resonance, and it's no longer there as a parasitic element. Knock it far enough out of resonance, it becomes transparent, and now it's a normal dipole pattern without the high directivity squirting the signal like a flashlight. I hope you see what I'm saying on this one, Alan. KB2, GRI, KQRIWB in the tech net.
Okay, this is KB2, GLI. Gee, I like that, Dick. You give me some real food for thought. I think that's going to be my next direction on this little project here. But remember I said, this thing only cost me $11 to make.
Hey, Alan, with all of your resources, you can invest another $11 with this remotely powered relay by flipping in an inductor, a capacitor, and a third element. To make it a inductor, a capacitor, to make it a director or reflector or a transparent element. So, with all your resources there, Steve, invest another $11. I think you're going to have a real fun-like antenna. And so, what you're doing is the next step inside your apartment, very similar to a stepper IR, but you're going to be using a relay as opposed to a stepper motor for changing the electrical length. As you do these experiments, please come back and let us know how it goes. KB2GLI, for any other comment, KTY WMZ man.
KW2SAY, the third element is an open circuit.
That's exactly right. The third element is an open circuit. So you're going to create inductor, capacitor, or open circuit. Back to you, Steve. KB2GLI. KTYIW.
Okay, Dick, very good. I'll keep you guys posted on what goes on here. You give me some good ideas. There is additional hope I could move to the second floor. Then I'd only have to fight the rain gutters. All right, on that note, I'll turn it back to you so you can move on. Thank you.
And as I see it, don't worry about fighting the rain gutters. All of the structures in your house and around your house, like a guy might have his dipole 60 feet in the air, and he's got the flyer to power and light, the power line, exactly 60 feet in the air, directly in front of him, to his favorite direction toward Europe. And you would think that those power lines are going to create a shadow. Absolutely not. Those power lines are thoroughly transparent as long as they don't hit resonant frequency. They're transparent. Your gutters, as they look to your eye, are radio-wise transparent as long as they're not resonant. And even if they are resonant, and you can find that out, you can easily knock them out of resonance by, you know, cutting the gutter in the middle and putting in a plastic insulator at that point. So as long as those gutters are not resonant, they are transparent. And so the second floor should work like a charm. Okay, let's see, John, KC2WGB, do you have the ability tonight to talk on 975-375, in which case I recommend we do that, in order for you and I to go over to the mailbag. KC2WGB, K2WGB, check that.
AOC with a question.
2AOC. We're going to get you in a second. Let me see if I can get John first here. KC2WGB. John, do you have the ability tonight to go to 147-975-375? You got it, John.
KC2WGB. You got me, Dick?
Fantastic. I'm copying. Very well, John. So go right ahead with the mailbag. And then AOC will pick up with you right after that. You got it there, John.
Okay, Dick. KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick, and everybody on the net. Got a question here from a gentleman named Gabe. Doing some work on audio amplifiers and doing some analyzing with square waves. He wants to know what the cause of overshoot on the leading edge on the square wave. He knows it's not the generator. It's something in the amplifier. What is it in the amplifier that causes that? Back to you, Dick. Maybe you can give him a rundown on that. KC2WG.
Yes, I think I can. One of the ways of testing a audio amplifier, or any kind of a broadband amplifier, is to either sweep it from the low frequency to high frequency and measure the response of each of those frequencies. And if you really want to do a thorough test, you're not only measuring, you know, does it have the same amount of gain at low, medium, and high frequencies, but does it have the exact same amount of phase shift? I'll admit that part is a little bit difficult to find. Another way of testing an amplifier is to put in a waveform that has a whole lot of simultaneous frequencies to it. Turns out that a square wave has a whole lot of low, medium, and high frequencies. If your square wave is running at 1 kilohertz, then a square wave really contains a whole lot of 1 kilohertz, 3 kilohertz, 5 kilohertz, 7 kilohertz. All of the odd frequencies are there and a fairly symmetric 50-50 square wave. If your particular amplifier happens to favor the higher frequencies more than the lower frequencies, the higher frequencies happen to be those sharp edges where there's a rapid rise or a rapid fall. Let me drop. Better repeat. The higher frequencies are the rapid rise and the rapid fall of a square wave are where the higher frequencies are present. If your particular amplifier favors those higher frequencies, then when you send your beautiful square wave signal through the amplifier, you will see these overshoots on the leading edges and trailing edges. That's telling you the higher frequencies are coming through stronger than the lower frequencies. Third and fifth harmonic are coming through stronger than the fundamental. That's on the assumption the amplifier is not simultaneously creating a phase shift. A truly linear amplifier will pass all of those frequencies with the exact same amplitude and the exact same amount of phase shift to all of those signals. There are ways you can readjust the amplifier, sometimes putting in the opposite of peaking coils. If you put in peaking coils, you're favoring the higher frequencies. You can put in just the right amount of loading capacitor and correct this. You'll notice that when you use an oscilloscope probe, a 10-to-1 oscilloscope probe on your oscilloscope, and you connect to the square wave calibrator, and you're adjusting the ring on the oscilloscope probe. Let me drop. You adjust that ring on the oscilloscope probe so that the square wave comes out as a pure square wave on the screen. You're adjusting the frequency response of that oscilloscope probe, whether or not it favors high frequencies or low frequencies, or what you're really doing. So there's ways of doing that with your amplifier. That's where the overshoot is coming from. KC2WGB, K2YIW on the TechNet.
It's all right, but...
KC2WGB, you copy, Dick?
I'm copying beautifully. Then go right ahead, then, John.
Okay, well, we had a couple of antenna questions tonight, so we have a few more. All right, this gentleman only has a specific line on his property where he can place an antenna. He has an inverted V for 40 meters. He wants to place a 20-meter inverted V directly below it in the same alignment. He'd like to know what you think about that idea and the spacing. Rules should we follow, if any, and the 40 meter is working very well for him, and he just wants to get a 20 to do the same thing. So what do you think of that idea, Dick? KC2 WGB, back to you.
2KW. We've all heard about the so-called fan dipole. Fan dipole is one where you build a whole lot of dipoles all parallel to each other. Connecting them all to a common point in the center. Nice.
Meters are going to be go with it,
did not come through. K2EJ, K2LIW.
They come back to 375, is that better?
Yes, it is, John. So why don't you repeat your last transmission on 975-375. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
KC2WGB. Okay, Dick. It's a 30-meter dipole on top, and he's going to have a 20-meter below it. And the maximum separation he can achieve is about 3 feet. So you think that's still a goal for
him? I say absolutely. 3 feet is more than enough. He's worried. I'll admit that the higher frequency dipole will see some extra capacitive loading of the lower frequency dipole with the 3-foot spacing. So the lower frequency, the higher frequency dipole will be shifted a little bit lower because of that capacitive loading and can readjust the length accordingly and bring it right back to resonance. The lower frequency, the longer dipole, will not even know the shorter one is there. It's going to fly. So I say go for it. And back to you, John. And go to the next one if you like. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Go ahead, Eric. Remote receiving.
I heard you say the word remote receiver, but Eric, go ahead.
Are you listening to one of the remote receivers?
My hands are pretty full, flick back and forth between 2585 and 975-375. So, can I go to that third receiver and keep track of what I'm doing? I'm going to get confused. It's really I can do it, but I need a third head and another set of hands, Eric. Go ahead.
Yeah, what I'm trying to tell you is if you're listening to one of the remote receivers, the one closest to you, I can tell you some stuff.
Okay. I'm not sure I can use that information right now, if you know what I mean. My ability these days is to transmit on 975-375 or 2585, and yes, you can transmit information to me, and yes, I can transmit on back on those. Are you recommending that I do some transmitting on one of those isolated frequencies, Eric? Go ahead.
No, I'm not. What I'm recommending is that you listen to one of those things so I can tell you, give you some information.
Okay, I'll try to do that. Alrighty, John, go on with your next question. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Okay, Dick, thanks for your patience. Okay, another antenna question. All right, this gentleman is building an antenna. He hasn't put it up yet. But the only thing he can do is use zip cord, like lamp cord.
Okay.
And it's number 14 gauge. What he wants to do is put it up as a dipole, so he'll have two conductors running, say, north, and two conductors running south. The connection will be in the center. Now, one of the leads running north will be cut shorter for a higher frequency. The same thing on the conductors going south. But they're very close together. They're not going to be used at the same time. Your again wants to know, will that work? And, of course, he has a balun. And he didn't tell me the frequencies, but I'm going to assume they're 20 and 40 meters somewhere in that area because of the lengths.
If I understand correctly, two conductors north, two conductors south, tuned to different frequencies. It sounds to me like it is a kind of fan dipole where he's fanning it out in azimuth as opposed to fanning it out in elevation. That's what I think I'm hearing. I'm going to pass it back to you for a correction of that. So a fan dipole that you fan in azimuth instead of in elevation, or you can do the combination. Fan it simultaneously in azimuth or elevation, as long as there's some kind of fanning at all. the individual dipoles will act essentially independently. So is it an azimuthal fanning of a dipole? Is that what you're describing, John? KC2WGB, K2LIW?
Yeah, this number 14 gauge zip cord is two conductors Siamese together, and he's not separating the conductors, and one group is running north and one is south, and each one of the pair of conductors are part of a dipole. Well, maybe you got it now.
Yes, I do, and now that's not quite as pleasant. Unfortunately, when you're using a zip cord for a fan dipole, where the two different conductors of the zip are the two different elements, the amount of interaction you get now is huge. The lower frequency, longer wire is going to work like a charm. The higher frequency, shorter wires are going to see a huge amount of capacitive coupling because they're now separated by a third of an inch as opposed to 3 feet. So the amount of retuning required of the lower, the shorter wires, the higher frequency wires, is going to be a lot greater. There have been designs like this, though. Don't be discouraged. There are guys who have taken the 4 or 8 conductor wire that's used for either Cat 5 or for rotator control, and they've cut the individual wires inside to the right length and made the equivalent of a fan dipole out of that, which now physically looks like one simple piece of structure, and it's got all these individual resonators inside. That does work electronically, but the amount of retuning required for the shorter pieces, the higher frequency portions, the amount of retuning required to reestablish resonance is quite huge. So unless you're copying somebody's design, it is going to take quite a bit of work. It can work, but there's that extra difficulty because your fan angle now is essentially zero. Do you see what's going on there, John? KC2WGB, K2LIW.
KC2WGB. Oh, absolutely, Dick. One question that I have, would it help, he does have a balun on this, would it help the relay there to switch from the shorter wires to the longer wires directly from the balun? Would that alleviate any of that problem?
Well, that's a good one. By way of relays and balance, can you knock it out of resonance? See, let's assume now that just for my example, I'm building an 80-meter and a 40-meter dipole out of zip cord. The 80-meter dipole is going to be very happy. The 40-meter dipole is going to, at first, be electronically much too long. It's getting a huge amount of capacitive loading at the end of the 40-meter dipole looking at the middle of the 80-meter dipole. And now, if I knock the 80-meter dipole out of resonance by opening up its relay, is that going to stop the capacitive effect? And I think the answer is no. It'll change the tuning, but it's not going to remove the effect. So I think the answer is no, John. By using a relay, by using switching and relays in that environment, I don't think you're going to stop the shorter dipole, the higher frequency dipole, from seeing all that extra metal of the 80-meter dipole there, whether it's in resonance or not. So I think that's not much of a solution. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
WH2SNAY, question.
K2WGB. Okay, Dick. Well, one of the suggestions, instead of running zip cord, could he run one and put the relays, two relays,
the presence of the wire of the 80-meter dipole, whether it's in resonance, out of resonance, no matter how you chop it up, unless you've got relays in just the right spot, rather than all this elaborate relaying function on the 80-meter dipole in order to make the 40 work, I think you're better off either really spacing the 40-meter dipole zip cord, or I think you're better off readjusting the length of the 40-meter dipole. That's my recommendation. Doug, I know you've got a question on this. W-H-O-S-T-Y-K-2-L-I-W.
Yeah, Dick, I wonder whether EasyNeck would be able to model that so that you could tune the shorter wire with EasyNeck. And and then just put it to whatever the program tells you. What do you think?
I think the answer is probably yes, Doug. Properly used in the right version of Ethernet, I think it can do it. Yep. And now, if you're going through all of that effort of doing all this modeling with EasyNet in order to try to make it work in this terrible environment, I think the average guy is going to get a lot more bang for the dollar by making a real fan dipole, by using the real free spacing as opposed to the third of an inch spacing inside of the zip cord. That's my recommendation on that one, Doug. W2SAY, K2LAW.
Well, the advantage of the EasyNet is that you can do it indoors, and you don't have to put separate supports for the short element.
Okay, I agree that the indoor environment with EasyNet sounds like a way to go. So, I'm going to say it's not going to work. I'm only going to say it's going to take quite a bit of effort. But for a crafty guy, I think indoors he can make a fan dipole. If his wife will let him put up a dipole at all across the ceiling, under the rug, around the walls, around the edges where the wall meets the floor, and so on, there's a zillion ways you can hide the wire of the dipole and bring it into resonance and not make it physically show. With a little bit of increased craftiness, the other dipole can be strung in a slightly different manner so that it is a fan. And it doesn't have to look like the classic fan where each antenna is another V inside of the other piece, you know what I mean? You can zigzag one of them, you can zigzag one of them and zigzag the other one. And even though the wires cross over each other at certain points, the crossover is an extremely minor capacitive loading of one to the other. So to make it a real fan inside the house, I think is a slightly easier way to go. But for a guy who's enthusiastic enough, go ahead and EasyNet it. And once you do find a solution, write an article on it and let us know about it. Back to you, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Very good, Dave. KC2WGB. It sounds like two antennas, one end of the other, like the other gentleman with the inverted V. Landlord problem, that I don't know. But that's about it from the Red Egg. And thank you for the response. And I can't wait to hear from Paul. I hear that NASA is talking about crashing some items onto the moon. I'd like to hear about that if it knows. Back to you, Paul.
Okay, thank you,
John.
Have a when we go over to the space report, which is right now, something has been crashing into the moon. That sounds good. And I also discovered something that I'll be adding to the space report a little bit later. WS2N at the space report. K2LAW. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, Paul.
I'm going to go on the input, and we've dealt with
it. 975-375, WS2N, K2LAW.
Okay, now I'm through, Selvin. Here we go. I'll copy now.
Fantastic. That's the right way to do it. Keep going. You got it, Paul.
Okay, yeah, I'd reverse things. I'd move my antenna and everything before. Okay, very good. Yeah, all right, Dick, talking about the Grail mission came to an end after about a year of orbiting the moon. Been in a polar orbit for that whole time. They got as low as, they broke around, 39 miles over the moon, which is pretty low. The orbital flight of the Apollo spacecraft was around 60 miles, so half that distance. And then for the last half of the year, they brought it down to 14 miles. So they're very low. Two spacecraft flying in tandem and checking out all the different areas of mass. Let me drop. Yeah, mission finally has come to an end. They got all their data, and now they're going to crash both probes into the moon, I think, tomorrow p.m., around 5:30 or something, 5:38, I think the time is, but they're going to crash both probes into the northern part of the moon, far away from any of the landing missions that have been up there. So that's going to be the end of that. They'll crash 20 seconds apart. You know, those don't get too, and they were named Evan, oh, they gave them names after they were up there a while. That's relatively close they were to one another. They'll be hitting around 3,000, 4,000 miles per hour. And that's pretty much it. I don't think they're doing any kind of experiments that I know of, like they did with the one that they impacted a couple of years ago down by Shackleton Crater around the South Pole. I think that, I don't know of any telescopes or anything that's going to be looking at this, except for maybe the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter that's still in orbit, the LRO. That'll be looking down. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
Interesting. In the case of the Grail, I believe that pair of spacecrafts on Grail were a very specific distance apart from each other, polar orbit, and by an extremely precise method of measuring the distance between the two, I think it was laser ranging or something like that, they were able to do a gravity mapping. In other words, when one of those Grail spacecraft passes over a gravity concentration on the moon, it reacts by tipping down a little bit, changing the, making a minor change of the range between the two spacecraft. And so the recording system measures the precise range between the two spacecraft as they do this polar orbiting, as the moon slowly rotates once per month underneath. And therefore, you eventually do a gravity mapping of the moon. When you analyze that data deep enough, you know where the mass concentrations are at various altitudes or various depths below the moon. Very crafty system. And so at the end of that mission, if I understand correctly, where they used to fly at 39 miles and then flew at 14 miles, are going to be crashing to the moon at 5:38 tomorrow morning. I'm amazed that they didn't decide to let them run a little bit longer, Paul, because as you keep refining the data, you would think you would get higher and higher resolution. Let me drop. You'd be getting higher and higher resolution as you refine the data by letting the project run a little longer. I'm guessing that project has already run something like 2 years so far. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Well, I think it took 3 or 4 months to get there. It was a slow increase of, one of these elliptical deals. Took many months instead of like the 3 or 4 days for an Apollo spacecraft to get there. And it's a cheaper way to go. So it killed a couple of months doing that, and then it got into orbit around this time last year, if I'm not mistaken. So about a year. And yeah, they could have, I guess they could have left it up there a little bit longer. I mean, there's no real atmosphere to, to deorbit these things. If you left something in a low Earth orbit with the expansion of the atmosphere on Earth from the sun, you're going to get some kind of atoms that are going to interfere with the spacecraft, and eventually it would go down and it would deorbit and then crash wherever it wants to. I mean, these things could have stayed in orbit like forever with no atmosphere at all to slow them down. So, I would have left them up there, but I don't know what the reasoning is outside of they just...
No one leaves anything in orbit to me.
You just put
more garbage on the moon. Somebody, a couple hundred
years from now, is going to have to clean up. But there's done this kind of... And the spacecraft crashed into the moon when the astronauts...
It's been on the moon. They discovered the moon quakes like that. We dropped
it.
Did you measure
from a Russian
craft from a
footage of a booth that crashed into the moon. These things all got, you know, they got readings and measurements. And then when they found out there were other similar measurements, they realized that. And
nothing was crashing into the moon.
Right. The moon was discovered years.
Fallout.
the actual putting mankind on Mars. You guys have heard me before say that I'm very skeptical of that, because to maintain a human being in space is a very difficult thing to do. You consume an amount of mass of material that's about as heavy as your house, and it's got the volume of your house. That's the raw materials required to keep you alive for a year. The air, water, and food. So to support all that is a heroic effort, and I just don't think we're going to do it. On top of that, the dangers involved of going to Mars are so great that the chances of sending somebody there and getting him back alive are not so good. Let me drop. And to answer your other question, Paul, how did I do as far as being in the hospital last week during the TechNet? The good news is they eventually, at my request, put me in the fifth floor of the building, the top of the building. That's the good news. The bad news is I'm in the most eastern end of the building with a window that aims to the north. The building itself is a massive structure where all of Limark is to the southwest of where I was. And as such, the chances of me hearing the signal through all of the steel of that building is not so good. The building is located on a piece of land. It's about 50 feet above sea level. It's in a well of Huntington, which is all the land surrounding is about 250 feet high. Let me drop. The bottom line of all that is that you guys have heard me say so many times that whenever you issue a radio signal, it goes everywhere in the universe. But all we have to discuss is how strong is it when it gets there. Well, I've been walking around this floor of the ward that I'm in, go to every single window, try the number of the rooms, the handy talkie in my hand, and the only place where I could get the tiniest amount of signal is if I held the handy talkie in the Statue of Liberty mode. At the highest I could get of the window in my room aimed to the north, I could hear a tiny bit of signal. I had my son bring me some coaxial cables so I could make a bazooka dipole, coaxial cable type dipole, and with only a Swiss Army knife and that raw material in a hotel room, the next question is, how do you make a dipole of the right length? Let me drop. And ordinarily, whether or not it's exactly the right length. Let me do a quick experiment. Stand by. Looks like I've got to keep transmitting in this way. I'd rather make the dipole exactly the right length because I knew the signal was going to be super weak. And if I was a little bit off resonance and I lost half a dB, the curtains. So to make a dipole exactly 19 inches length and you don't have a ruler and you're in a hotel room with a Swiss Army knife, the bit of craftiness I thought I came up with is that the hospital had given me all kinds of paperwork to sign that was on 8.5 by 11 pieces of paper. If I took one piece of paper 11 inches long, put alongside of it another piece of paper at right angles, 8 inches long, that makes 19.5 inches total. That was my ruler to make the dipole exactly the right length. My son had brought me some nice clear packing tape that allowed me to tape this dipole on the window and run the coax cable down the side of the window, across the windowsill, across the floor, taped, and over to the bed where I was. And then with the handy talkie propped up with a pillow so that the loudspeaker is right against my ear, I had the equivalent of an earphone on one side. What I was able to get in that terrible environment is an amount of signal that was about 50% audio and 50% noise. It was a very noisy signal. So I thought I was going to listen to the tech net. Well, these people, when you're in the hospital, seems like every 10 minutes somebody's coming in. Let me drop. Somebody's coming in every 10 minutes measuring vital signs, measuring blood pressure, measuring temperature, giving you an IV, giving you medicine you're supposed to take, talking to you about the operation that's going to take place the next day. Every 5 or 10 minutes, an interruption is taking place. I tried having conversations Sunday afternoon with John. I called him on the phone, and all these terrible interruptions kept happening, and so I needed to talk to him for about a half hour or 40 minutes. It took 5 separate phone calls with all of these interruptions before I finally got the message through to John, if you know what I mean, the things I wanted to say to him. Because they wouldn't leave me alone like that. Once every day or so, you want to wash yourself up. They don't have a shower. They only have a sink in the bathroom. And so to wash yourself correctly in a sink, to do the equivalent of a shower, for me, is a fairly difficult process because signs are all over the place. Protect yourself and don't touch this, don't touch that. So when you're trying to do a shower in a sink where you're spreading paper towels all over the place, make sure you don't touch anything you shouldn't be touching in the bathroom. Very lengthy process. They would never leave you alone long enough during the day to do that. So I had to do the washing at 3 o'clock in the morning. So there's a whole lot of experiences I've had in the hospital in the 40 days that I was there. That's another whole story. But let me tell you one other thing I discovered that day. And that is, before I went to the hospital, there was a NASA website I went to where they're discovering what black holes they're now being able to measure by way of Chandra and the infrared telescopes and so on. They're slowly discovering that essentially every single galaxy has a supermassive black hole in the center, which is the source of the gravity that holds it all together. And up till now, there seemed to be a direct proportion. In other words, a bigger galaxy really had a bigger black hole that's holding it all together. A smaller galaxy has a smaller one. The Andromeda galaxy has a black hole that, as I remember, is something like 50 million solar masses. And let me give you a couple of words on that one. I mean, we all know that the Earth is a very massive thing. But it's only one of nine planets, and Jupiter and Saturn are a hell of a lot bigger and more massive. But these planets are going around the Sun. The Sun is a really big object, close to a million miles in diameter. Of all the stuff that's in this solar system, nine planets in the old days, eight now, the Oort cloud and the Kuiper belt, all of that stuff is all being held together by a Sun, a supermassive object. 99% of the mass of this solar system is in the Sun. And now you get a galaxy like ours, or like the Andromeda galaxy, and you get some number of millions of solar masses as a black hole in the center to hold that all together. Well, in the last couple of weeks, NASA has discovered what they think is the heaviest thing they've ever seen to date. Let me drop up. And that is, there's a relatively small galaxy, which they expected on the analyzer to have a relatively small black hole. But it's got the biggest thing they've ever seen. This particular black hole is somewhere between 14 and 20 billion. That's a B boy. 14 to 20 billion solar masses in this medium small galaxy. That's got them really confused. Is the galaxy small because it ate everything it was in it and it became part of the black hole? Or is it really a combination of multiple galaxies? Nobody knows what the hell it is. 14 to 20 billion solar masses. That's just out of sight. It's just, again, one of these situations where you build the biggest gamma ray burst detector you can, and you put it in space and you let it start taking measurements. It's only a short matter of time before you find something that's going to saturate your detector. The biggest blast you've ever seen, you're going to get a bigger one. Well, the biggest mass you've ever seen, you're going to eventually find a bigger one. Mother Nature's pretty random. I will not be able to everything that possible takes place. 14 to 20 billion solar masses. The amount of gravity lensing you must get around that thing is out of sight. If you're within that, I mean, this solar system, I think, is pretty big. At the speed of light, it takes light almost 11 hours to go across the solar system. And this is just a medium-sized sun. Just an average-sized sun. 14 to 20 billion solar masses. I wonder if you heard about that one, Paul. And what's your feeling on this? MV, WS2N, TQLIW, and TechNet?
I remember that about a week ago, I guess, and they talked about it as if it's one of they thought it's the heaviest. There might be another one. They were trying to figure it out. That's the last I heard. So, but now you're saying 20 billion. I thought they were saying 5 or 10 billion. So they must have come to some conclusion. And based on what you're saying, it sounds like now that must be the heaviest, densest one that they found. And as I remember reading that, it was the diameter was all the way out to the diameter of Neptune. Usually these things are relatively small. You know, you might have a black hole the size of the Earth or something. Or maybe like the one in the center of the Milky Way, maybe as big as the Sun, with, 5 million.